You're listening to Well Made, a podcast from Lumi about the people and ideas behind your favorite online brands. I'm your host, Stefan Ango. Casey Armstrong, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
So you are the chief marketing officer at ShipBob. I think a lot of our listeners would be familiar with ShipBob, but it's a fulfillment service that is digitally native. You are a company working with a lot of brands that we've featured on the show, probably many more who are interested in learning how to build their own e-commerce companies. How do you describe ShipBob today?
Yeah, so the buzzword answer would be a tech-enabled 3PL, but in layman's terms, we're really trying to bring Amazon-level shipping and logistics to fast-growing e-commerce brands.
And 3PL is a term that gets thrown around a lot, but what does that actually mean?
Yeah, we're your third-party logistics service. So that's what it exactly stands for, and it's a way to outsource that function of your business so you can focus on sales, marketing, product development, customer service, other elements of the business.
What is the difference between a distribution center, a fulfillment center, a warehouse, a 3PL? Is there some like clean way that you have of describing those things?
Yeah, so I lump fulfillment center and distribution center together. We use them relatively interchangeably, but a warehouse is definitely different. A warehouse, they're often located in more rural areas. They're really there to store products. If you're not moving a lot of product or if you have a lot of inventory, that's often a better route. And a fulfillment center, which is what we run at ShipBob, you know, those are to get orders to customers in a timely fashion. Oftentimes they're located in more urban hubs. With us, you know, we're in New York, San Francisco, LA, Chicago, Dallas, so large metropolitan areas. And oftentimes there's additional services that the fulfillment centers will provide as well, from how they receive your inventory, moving inventory across fulfillment centers, kitting items, packing boxes, using great partners such as Lumi in creating that, you know, that personal experience, managing returns and other elements like that.
So I've been kind of on every side of this idea of fulfillment for a long time, because in the first company that I ran with Jesse, we actually did fulfillment ourselves and then started working with a third-party logistics company, not ShipBob, but another one that kind of launched, I think, you know, earlier around 2010 or something like that. So I packed probably thousands of boxes myself that went to customers. Mm-hmm. And also figured out, you know, started putting stuff in 3PLs and started shipping out of there and started figuring out how to also sell to wholesale, to retailers, and how to figure out how to send that kind of, you know, pallet level product out from a warehouse or a 3PL. So, and now obviously with where Lumi is today, most of the time when we're producing packaging, the output of that is we're delivering to a ShipBob or another 3PL, or oftentimes as well for customers who are doing their own fulfillment at their own distribution centers. So I think what would be fun is to kind of go through a little bit of some of the fundamental questions that, you know, I think both of us come across on a daily basis of people who are trying to figure this out, sometimes for the first time, or sometimes it's that, you know, they've had some experience before, but the market has changed so much and the capabilities that are out there have changed so much. And so maybe the best place to start is just when someone is, you know, starting to think about working with a 3PL and, you know, they're pretty sure they don't want to do that work themselves. What should they be looking at as the different levers and choices that they need to make when they're trying to choose one?
Yeah, so I think probably the biggest driver for brands, especially that are thinking long term, I mean, you're gonna make that decision and that investment, and I'll call it an investment, even though you actually might be able to save money both in the short and the long term by working with the right partner, is you're really trying to provide a better experience for your customers. And I'd love to hear, you know, what motivated you to outsource it. But oftentimes people realize, you know, they're staying up till 2 or 3 in the morning and packing boxes themselves. I was actually in San Francisco the other week, and a friend of mine was telling me how he kept getting roped in on Saturdays where his friend was throwing these quote unquote packing parties, which was basically him trying to use pizza and beer as a carrot to get friends to come over to help him pack boxes because his e-commerce store was blowing up more than he thought it'd be.
I've definitely watched several movies doing that. Many movies about packing boxes.
I bet. All of a sudden your house starts to reek of cardboard and you're like, this is probably not the long-term solution. But again, just going back and just really focusing on your customers. And so that's what you're really trying to provide. It's probably, I mean, it's at the core of what Lumi's trying to provide. It's at the core of what we're trying to provide, which is a much better customer experience. But also part of that is, so how can you get products to customers in a shorter time period? And then also, how can you locate your inventory closer to your customers so that you can save money on the shipping costs as well? And so, you know, I can speak for what we do personally, and I would hope that a lot of the other solutions that you would talk to would as well. It always starts with, what does your customer data look like? And so that's where people should often start. And that's what I like as well, is how can you create actionable data? And so where are people buying from? And you can get that to the SKU level. So for example, if you're selling baby clothes, for example, we had a customer of ours and they had this cute little shark on some baby clothes. And unsurprisingly, they always sold closer to the coasts. And so they would often locate those similar SKUs, you know, in like a Los Angeles or San Francisco or New York or Florida or something like that.
So you're bringing up already, you know, one of the big things, which is just geography. I guess when I'm thinking about someone who's starting a brand or they've gotten to, you know, some level of product market fit, they're thinking about the options there. One that comes to mind is, how important is it for me to locate my 3PL close to the manufacturer versus close to my office versus close to my customers? Or maybe I want to go central in the middle of the United States so that I can hit both coasts. Like, what makes the most sense?
The real answer is it depends. Of course, every business is different. And so we can walk through each of those. So you mentioned your manufacturer. We work with a lot of companies that actually manufacture overseas. And so it's less of an issue there. I guess depending on what you're selling, you know, maybe co-locating close to the manufacturer would be helpful, but I find that to often be less important. And then to your office, you're, for the most part, having to hand off your product, which, you know, let's just call it your baby, off to somebody else to take care of it. And so some people, you know, they really want to be located close to the fulfillment center, but for the long-term success of the business, that's often not that important. You know, you should work with a fulfillment provider that you really view as a partner and is doing the best on your behalf and also your customer's behalf. And that takes us to the last one, and that's your customers. And so I would, depending on what your catalog mix and like SKU velocity and things like that look like, I would try to be as close as you can to your customers. You also called out, you know, being located in the middle of the country versus on the coast. And again, that often depends on your catalog. If you have thousands or tens of thousands of SKUs, and you don't necessarily have a lot of cash flow to start to split inventory, maybe it makes sense to be located more in the middle of the U.S. But if you have fewer SKUs and depending on what your customer profile looks like, or even if you have fewer SKUs in general, to be honest, from the data that we see, it really makes sense to split inventory at least across the coast and maybe across the coast and the middle of the country as well.
Yeah, and I'm assuming part of it is also, for example, we had several furniture companies on the program before. Those are really big, bulky items, relatively few SKUs. There's the notion of zones as well to consider in terms of UPS and FedEx and USPS have this notion of, you know, how far your product is going to travel kind of determines the shipping costs, but also for something that's very heavy, maybe it would make more sense to have it closer.
Definitely. Something that we look at a lot, and my team and I just ran a pretty thorough analysis just on splitting inventory just at a more macro level across, you know, the millions and millions of shipments that we sent out last year. So basically where you're shipping from, of course, the further you get away from where you're shipping from to where the consumer is, that's, you know, there will be more shipping zones. But the important data underneath that is often transit time. And so we've seen people, as they start to split inventory, see improvements, you know, from, you know, 30 to 40% improvements in transit time reduction, meaning going from, let's call it a little over 3 days to, you know, barely over 2 days or at 2 days. And then, of course, on the costs as well. And so, of course, the closer you are to the end consumer, you know, you're able to see a pretty big reduction in cost because obviously it's traveling in fewer zones as well.
You mentioned early on the word kitting. I think that's an interesting one that we should dive into. But one of the things that we've experienced, let me just kind of from our lens on the 3PL world, is that 3PLs tend to have pretty distinct different features and capabilities and unique things that some are good at and some aren't. Some 3PLs we've seen have a lot of strengths around printing and direct mail and have their own print on demand for apparel, for example. Some are really good at shipping a small number of SKUs. Others are really good at shipping, you know, for companies that have thousands and thousands of SKUs. Some do kitting, some don't do kitting. Some, you know, and so some do custom packaging and some don't. Some have, you know, a lot of automation and some are more focused around being able to do like very custom stuff and more of the labor and being able to do something special for each package. How does someone get to understand what's possible in the world of 3PLs and decide what's important to them?
Yeah, that's where I think talking to probably a couple options and well, first, of course, looking at what's important for you and where do you see opportunity in your business? And then starting to talk to some trusted partners, again, such as ShipBob, not just to plug us, because, you know, we'll be very clear with you. So for example, we'll actually work with furniture brands. Like we work with a company called Interior Define, but we might just only ship out their swatches, whereas we don't ship the actual extremely large bulky couch. But we do have logistics partners that's what they specialize in, and that's all that they focus on. And so their aisles will be 50% greater than your typical 3PL. And the machinery that they have will be able to take on that bulk of your inventory. But again, they won't touch smaller items because that's not part of their business model. There will be some companies that only want to have a handful of customers. And they'll focus, let's just say, directly on apparel and like reverse logistics. We focus primarily on these fast-growing often direct-to-consumer brands with often a lower SKU count. And because they're taking advantage of our distributed inventory, of the technology that we provide, the fact that we own the entire logistics stack, and it's also being able to scale up and down with the customers as well. So one of the things I love at ShipBob and when I was at BigCommerce prior and other solutions is you get to work with so many brands. And I'm sure you love this at Lumi as well, where you start to see you know, highs and lows of these businesses and you talk to them and you hear what's going on. And we had a customer about a year and a half ago that they won I think it was like the Time Toy of the Year. They were doing very modest volume, like let's say a couple hundred units a month. And then all of a sudden they had this month where they sold 25,000 units. Like how do you scale that fast if you're doing it yourself or if your partner's not built that way? We had another customer of ours where one of the British royal family were wearing their shoe products. And then all of a sudden they saw this huge spike.
I think you're talking about Birdies, right?
I'm talking about Birdies.
They were our listeners will be familiar because they were on the podcast and told the story behind that particular event.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
I love those stories. And then, you know, we had another where customer of ours where, you know, there was this natural disaster and they had a very unique solution to help solve this problem. They were shipping probably 8,000 to 10,000 units a month, which is, you know, very solid. But then they saw this huge spike, you know, of over between 15,000 and 20,000 units in a specific month, you know, before Q4, which is when everybody usually sees a huge spike. It's pretty interesting just to see that the ebbs and flows of just different brands. And again, just thinking through what actually happens when you have that success that you desire. So everybody, you know, will daydream at night and thinking about, well, you know, I can't wait for this to happen with my brand, but are you actually built to handle that success? We see that a lot with like Kickstarter projects where we work with have you heard of Rebel Girls, or do you guys maybe even work with Rebel Girls?
I don't know, and I don't know. no, I don't recognize the name.
It's pretty cool. I highly recommend it. They started by creating these kid books, which would especially for young girls, which would highlight powerful women throughout history. And they launched this Kickstarter project. I think they were based over in Italy at the time. Now they've moved over to the U.S. and they were expecting to sell, you know, a few hundred books. Next thing they knew, they'd sold thousands and thousands of books, and these were heavy books.
Wow.
And they're like, well, how are we going to get these to the to our customers? And so, you know, of course they're looking for a partner there. They've actually gone on not all through ShipBob, because a lot of what they've done is mass wholesale, but they've actually, since they started working with us about 4 years ago, I think they've sold like 3.5 million books. And then they just keep rolling out Kickstarter project again and again. And it's pretty interesting to see these highs and lows.
Well, that, you know, talking about Kickstarter is actually what pushed me and Jesse to actually use a fulfillment partner when we were running our previous business, IncoDive, because we did a Kickstarter campaign and we raised about $250,000 back in 2012. And it was, we knew, you know, going into it, we didn't expect to get that big, but we knew from the response that we were going to need help doing the fulfillment, because it was just not going to be practical for us to pack every box for that project. And, you know, that started our relationship with the 3PL. Ultimately, we decided to bring it back, mostly because we found that they weren't as strong working with retailers, and our business had started to shift more towards working with retail stores. And for them, the most important thing was being able to receive the products palletized in a very specific way. A lot of retailers, this was an art supply product, so we were in Joann's and Michael's and Urban Outfitters and different stores like that. And they'll give you like a compliance manual that's, you know, the size of the phone book, and you have to make sure that all of your pallets arrive in a specific way and labeled a certain way. And that's a very specific thing that not every 3PL is set up for. If your specialty is shipping direct to consumer, you know, your whole assembly area is going to be set up for things going into individual boxes. So that might be another thing that some are better at than others.
Definitely. B2B, EDI, I think that people selling offline and in some of these, you know, more traditional wholesale opportunities is going to, not that it's ever gone away, but I think a lot of these direct-to-consumer brands are going to start realizing that they need to start shifting budget maybe from some of their digital channels back to some of these offline opportunities. And both the malls and the wholesalers are, you know, they're seeing the shift and they're adopting as quickly as they can. And I think that they're creating options to allow these digitally native brands to go back towards the more traditional channels. And that's where you need to make sure your fulfillment provider or your manufacturer can help you facilitate that. Because there are a handful of ways to navigate that. But I think that people are going to start expanding what their views of like customer acquisition channels are. A lot of the more successful brands are already doing that or already in that process. Even some of the larger ones, like I saw Wayfair today, I believe it was, announced that they were opening their first physical location. And so I think we're going to start seeing that shift where people are, you know, they hit like this digital ceiling and they're going to try to break through that and start exploring some of the more, you know, traditional channels.
One of the things that was difficult about our relationship with that 3PL that I was mentioning is that when we wanted to start pulling our inventory back out, it was actually really problematic and led to them actually like wanting to give us a gag order that we were not able to like complain about their service, because essentially what had started happening is, as I was describing with the kind of B2B, you know, from our perspective, we were sending them pallets of product that was already packed into cartons and everything so that they could be reshipped as pallets. But for whatever reason, they would start breaking everything down right away. And so our products were like basically small bottles. And when they were sending it to retailers, they were just basically like dumping the unboxed product into bigger just boxes. And it was just a real nightmare. So when we started telling them we wanted to pull all our product out, they got really freaked out. And they were asking us to either, they would do it at a low cost or and that we needed to pay to basically sign this gag order, or that we needed to pay these really high fees to get our inventory back out. And that was a really pretty upsetting situation, but it really highlighted a dynamic that can be uncomfortable, I think, between brands and 3PLs, which is that your inventory is not in your control anymore. And so if situations like that come up, you know, what do you do about that? I'm obviously, I don't know anything about ShipBob's like way to handle that, but like on a more broad level, like how do you set up good relationships with your 3PL to avoid those kinds of situations?
I think, you know, there's a term we throw around a lot. People have their, I guess, different ways of putting it, but it's basically like reduce surprises. And so like with us, it's, we'd rather, of course, you know, we're looking to grow as, you know, efficiently and as fast as we can in the right manner, but, you know, heavy emphasis on the right manner, where it's, you know, we'd rather err on the side of bringing on only like the right customers so that you never get into those situations. And I think it's from the brand side, just being completely upfront on what your business is today and what you think it's going to be in the future. And actually reading through, like, you know, doing the the proper risk, you know, analysis of what actually happens if you do try to move. Because you really need to make sure who you work with you view as a partner, and you got to think long. I mean, I think just in general, people need to think long, and that's where it'll be interesting to see like how people view performance marketing, how that continues to evolve over time. Where it's, of course, that's very short term, which helps drive the business, but just, you know, really, because there are a lot of benefits of utilizing a 3PL. For example, you know, you don't have to sign a long-term lease for a warehouse or a fulfillment center. You don't need to buy a ton of boxes necessarily, and dollies and all the different equipment. You don't necessarily have to hire a bunch of people to work at the fulfillment center. But you know, to counter that with your example is, you also need to make sure that as your business grows, can your partner grow with you? And I'm sure you think about that a lot at Lumi as well, where you're bringing on the right brands. You know, I know a lot of people want to work with you guys, but it's making sure you guys bring on the right brands so you guys can grow together.
That brings up a great question, which is, I think some 3PLs have strengths with smaller companies versus medium size versus larger companies. How does one go about kind of assessing, because what the strengths of any given 3PL is? In your case, you know, I would love to hear how you would share it about ShipBob, but what are the types of questions that you would suggest people ask?
Probably asking if you can talk to some of their customers, and just if they're willing to open that up, because I think that will say a lot about them. And then asking them what they think they do well, and just asking for some examples at different ends of the spectrum. For us, it's really your business type. And like I mentioned, it's often these like lower SKU, high volume sellers. And whether you're shipping, you know, a couple hundred products a month or tens of thousands a month or a week, you know, we can scale up and down with you. But again, it's making sure that your business type, it aligns with our model. And then I mentioned that other 3PL earlier, where similarly, the one that can take on bulky items, they don't really mind as much about, you know, your how many shipments per month, as long as it's, you know, reasonably decent. But it's often they're not going to ship small products, and so the more you can dig into like what their customers are saying and possibly talk to some customers, I always find that helps a lot.
When we talk about pricing around 3PL, typically there are a few different kinds of things that you're paying for. You've got storage, which is, you know, just holding your inventory there. And then there's pick and pack fees and maybe kitting fees. How do you see pricing And what should people look for in, when it comes to how much these services cost?
That's a great question, because there's so many different ways you can go about it. And, you know, regardless of what the business is. So with us, it's a nominal receiving fee, and then there's some storage fee, and then everything else is lumped into a shipping fee. And it's really understanding, like, are people going to nickel and dime you for every little thing that you do, and maybe every single phone call that you make? And do you actually have like an account manager or somebody that you can contact? Or are you just kind of sending your products over there and hoping that they do a good job, and you're just going to really get hit with line item after line item? And so there's definitely some complexities there. And the more transparent and simplified the pricing, the better.
I would love for you to peel back the layers of how your business model actually works, and what are the cost drivers or the things that actually make you choose to go in one direction or another, in terms of, you know, you've decided specifically to bundle a lot of these things under one fee, but other companies will split them out in different ways. Like, what are the economic incentives that you have as a business?
A lot of it comes, and I really saw this a lot when I was looking at ShipBob and made the jump over there, which is the founder's focus on the customers and, you know, what would be most beneficial for them. And honestly, like, time and time again, they always just would rather err on the side of what's best for the customer. And in this case, it's that transparent, simplified pricing, where oftentimes, you know, whether you're buying a kind of an old school enterprise technology solution or looking at a 3PL, you know, these markets that are getting disrupted, it's just these extremely complex, difficult to understand pricing models. And so people end up just maybe unhappily paying or just getting wound up in a bunch of unnecessary back and forth. And so with us, that's definitely the key driver. And then also with ours, it's really betting that we can build and scale and expand our network, you know, across the US, and then, you know, in the future across North America and, you know, internationally, where we can take advantage of also a lot of the data that we're able to pull in across the execution, again, across the entire network, so we can just make much smarter decisions. And again, there we'd rather like allocate those wins across all of our customers.
One thing that maybe is not totally obvious to people is the business model differs a little bit from one 3PL to the next, in the sense that some are more vertically integrated than others. So you have the actual physical location where, you know, the warehouse and fulfillment location, and then you have the software that it runs on. And so some 3PLs will use external software to like manage like a warehouse management system. And then there's also another layer on top of that, which is access to the warehouses and creating a network of warehouses or distribution centers. So you often find that some 3PLs will have perhaps a software layer on top, and they don't own any of the warehouses or any of the software. You have some that will have a software layer on top and own maybe one or two distribution centers, but then they will outsource other locations to other companies. You have companies that do the full stack. Like, so maybe explain a little bit of that and where ShipBob fits in.
Yeah, and I'll try to give fewer ShipBob plugs shortly, but definitely to dive in there, we're in the full stack department. And again, this is another thing that I give a lot of credit, obviously, to our founders in driving this, where, again, I think this is playing the long game, where the software that our customers use, the ShipBob product that we built, something that I didn't even realize until I joined, was maybe 50%, if not more, of our development resources actually goes into the warehouse management software that we use in the facilities. And so that's ShipBob IP as well. And then we run and control all of our fulfillment centers. And then also all of the people that work in the fulfillment centers are ShipBob employees as well. And so there are definitely other ways you can go about it. Running logistics is not easy. And anybody who tells you otherwise, and you're in the same space, like, I'm sure you would, you know, smile and nod at that as well, where it's not easy. And I see the things that we try to overcome, you know, on a daily or weekly or monthly basis. And that's with us controlling the entire stack. You know, I'm not really sure how businesses do it where they don't. And again, it's pretty interesting to see that so much time was put into building the software that's even used in the facilities. We just really wanted everything just to integrate completely seamlessly.
Yeah, I mean, I think that looking at it from the outside, I don't really understand fully, you know, how the money flows through the organization. But I think it makes sense to me that some companies decide to only focus maybe on the top level software, because obviously hiring a bunch of employees, making an investment, you know, leasing space, having all the equipment is expensive. So having to go out and having the capital to even be able to do that is a big challenge in its own right. And then on the flip side, you've got people who have that competency or have that warehouse space, or, you know, and they turn it into a fulfillment center, but don't necessarily have the expertise to build the software. So I understand where it works in both directions. Having the full stack seems like the benefit there is that perhaps you can capture a little bit more margin because you now kind of own every piece of it. And so you're not having to split the margin with a partner. But on the other hand, it seems like the trade-off would be that your growth is automatically slower, because if you have to pay for all of that upfront cost of having to you know, set up a new distribution center, it makes it a little less quick to roll out a very widespread network. Is that fair?
I don't know if it hurt our growth at all. I actually would say it's probably helped, just because it's allowed us to make smarter and faster decisions across the entire network in how we actually distribute the inventory. And something that we're rolling out definitely in Q2 is really demand planning and demand management at the SKU level for all of our customers. And by having the software that we use in the warehouses or the fulfillment centers, of course, natively integrate with the software that our customers are using, and have that work across the entire network, just the data just flows much cleaner. And I think we can make much smarter decisions in real time. And so it's actually been very beneficial. And even as we, you know, an order comes in and we think through, okay, where the end consumer is located in this spot, we have these products located in which fulfillment centers, and how are we going to fulfill that and get that to them in the most cost-effective manner and as fast as possible. We actually have like a 2-day express program that does exactly that. It's pretty cool. So actually, if you go to like a company like Mycom Blanket, we just did a case study with them. And when they rolled this out, they actually saw like almost a 20% reduction in cart abandonment. And so what happens is, if somebody is, let's say, in Chicago and they go to purchase this specific product, while they put it in their cart, Shopify is already talking to ShipBob and saying, okay, this person is located in this location and the product that they have in the cart is X, and product X is located in which of your fulfillment centers. Okay, how quickly can we get that to them? And what are the different shipping methods that we can get this to the customer? And so a lot of that's running in the background, like before you even get to the checkout page. Again, if we didn't own the entire stack, I have no idea how we'd be able to pull that off.
Yeah, and I think that highlights the value of owning the entire stack. I think where I was going with my comparison is just that it seems kind of obvious that it will make it harder for you to say have like 40 or 100 different distribution centers overnight, because you have to make that investment each time to get it up and going.
Oh, yes, definitely. You can scale pretty big with, you know, like for example, we have 5 right now, but agreed. I mean, we're not Amazon, who has thousands, that's for sure.
Does Amazon actually have thousands of distribution centers at this point?
They might. So something I think about a lot is like, just, you know, there's like this expectation shift that like Amazon and the other, you know, kind of incumbent players like Target and Walmart are driving at the top, and then kind of bottoms up like what the customers are expecting, and therefore it falls to everybody in the middle, which is these kind of cooler, newer brands often selling directly to the consumer. How do they actually provide that that Amazon level service. And some of these larger brands are going about it in a variety of ways. Like, for example, Target, I want to say Target has something like close to 1,800 or 2,000 stores across the US, and they use 90% of them as basically pseudo fulfillment centers, or probably not even pseudo, as actually fulfillment centers. And so that's how they're often able to get inventory to their customers very quickly. And so in that case, you know, that's over 1,500 fulfillment centers.
Let's talk about Amazon for a second, because obviously they've been driving a tremendous amount of innovation in the area, as well as just consumer expectation. They've been kind of rising the bar of what people expect when they're buying something online, that they're going to be able to get, you know, free shipping, that it's going to come rapidly, that if they have a problem with it, they can send it back easily. And that's a high bar to meet if you're, a young brand or a company that doesn't necessarily have the ability to like build all that stuff. You know, the first one I think that is now, you know, a widespread thing, and maybe you can shed some light on, is just the idea of free shipping, which is somebody pays for the shipping, right? I mean, shipping is not free. Eventually, you know, either the brand pays for it or something, you know, has to happen. What is, in your mind, the state of free shipping today? Because Amazon has just continually risen what that means in terms of the amount of time that you can get a product within.
I mean, they basically have made it table stakes. And, you know, I mentioned Rebel Girls earlier. Their CEO said that to us verbatim during the holidays when she was rolling out free two-day shipping. Michael and Blanket, again, they did as well. With Amazon, they have the luxury of, I mean, they poured billions of dollars into creating this. And then you also pay for Amazon Prime, which I actually don't even recall what it costs anymore. I remember it used to cost $80 a year. I think it's now, what, like 120 or so?
I think so. I think it might be more than that even. But yeah, somewhere around 150 or something, I think.
And they throw in all these other perks, you know, like movies and other digital products, which the margins there are, you know, insane. And again, they're taking a majority of that to offset a lot of the two-day shipping costs. I mean, I think 80% of U.S. households have Amazon Prime. But what Amazon sees, and we actually see some similar numbers, what Amazon sees is, I think a Amazon Prime customer spends something like 130% more per year on Amazon than a non-Prime customer. And so it's not apples to apples here, but we've actually seen some similar improvements on the average order value or the AOV, where people that have offered that free two-day shipping, and I think part of it is, you know, it's kind of like the customer delight. They're happy that they get it. It's what they expect now from Amazon, but it's also like that trustworthiness. We've seen customers have between 25% plus improvements in average order value. And then this other company we work with, I Love Plum, they saw like a 97% increase in average order value when they rolled out that free two-day shipping. I would not set that as like your expectations now, because that's what one company achieved. But that's fascinating, where if you think through what are the levers you have as a brand that you can actually pull to improve your bottom line. And so there's, of course, what does it cost to get somebody on your website? Then what are the conversion rates to purchase? And then what is that average order value? And of course, this is like an extremely simplified way to view how to calculate revenue, but that's basically three different levers. And so many people just focus on top of the funnel, but how can you actually focus on something like that post-purchase experience? And so, and how can you bring that front and center to your customer, where you can improve those conversion rates and you can increase that average order value? And we see it time and time again, and Amazon is pretty public with some of this data as well, and how they see it, just that oftentimes can help cover that free two-day shipping. Because like you said, nothing is free. You know, somebody's paying for it somewhere.
Yeah. And how do you give people advice on how do you blend that into the unit price of the product?
We will sometimes. It depends. I mean, we have a lot of customers. Some of them like to work closer with us and some of them like to do everything on their own. But, you know, it really depends. Here's a good example. So I mentioned Mycom Blanket earlier. They sell gravity blankets, including the packaging and everything. They often weigh between 20 and 30 pounds. And they were shipping, I think, everything before they moved to us, everything out of Florida. So naturally, anything you're going to send to the West Coast is going to be extremely expensive. And they wanted to offer that two-day shipping. And it was costing them, you know, over $100 to ship a product that only costs, you know, between $150 and $250. That's, you know, that's 40% of the wallet share at the high end, which is astronomical. You know, by splitting their inventory, they were able to now not just offer that two-day shipping, but free two-day shipping, because they were able to get their average shipping cost to be around like $23 to $27. And so they saw this huge reduction, and then they were able to provide that. And then also by now showcasing this free two-day shipping, where they're now saving a bunch of money, they were also able to see improvements in conversion rate. I don't know if they saw the average order value improvements as well, but they definitely did on the conversion rate data.
Do you see customers gaining more awareness of that simple idea that shipping isn't free? And that, you know, when I see that lately Amazon's been showing in the checkout flow, hey, do you want to get this slower? And it doesn't, I don't think you get a better price or anything, because it's already free to get it faster. But they're suggesting, hey, do you care about this? Do you want to get it slower? Does it matter to you? I wonder what that says about, you know, the level of education that customers have today.
In regards to getting things slower, we actually saw some of that bubble up when we were experimenting with some of our same day shipping in certain regions, where if it wasn't really a perishable or food product, you know, people did not want to pay that extra amount. And so a lot of our products, you know, people don't necessarily need their, you know, organic deodorant within, you know, 4 hours. They can wait that 36 hours or, you know, 48 hours or whatever it may be to get the product. And so I think that it really depends on what you are selling. Again, if you're not selling perishables or food, I think you can at least err on the side of, like, let's call it 2 days, which is still extremely fast.
One thing that I've noticed Shopify pushing really into lately is improving the experience across all Shopify stores for individual consumers. And what I mean by that is, now when I'm checking out on a Shopify store, if I put in my phone number, it remembers that I've already checked out on a Shopify store before and fills out all of my information, which is kind of fascinating. And I wonder, you know, in a future world, do you ever imagine ShipBob, if ShipBob were partnering with many different brands and you detected, hey, this same person bought something, it's going to the same address, but it's two different brands, would you ever like combine those together?
I love that concept. I mean, we need to get to the level of scale to do that, where it'd almost be like, you know, a ShipBob plus. Real quick back to the Shopify example. So I was at BigCommerce prior, and, you know, Shopify was easily our number one competitor when I was there. And I remember when Shopify rolled that out, and I'm not going to lie, I was very jealous, because I was like, wow, that is just, talk about value to the buyer. And also to the Shopify customer, where you're able to provide such a seamless checkout experience. It's almost like them dipping their toes into that kind of Shopify Prime type experience.
Well, it becomes this like meta Shopify, because each brand gets to be their own thing and have their own place on the web and you know, create an experience that feels unique. But you get some of the benefits of you know, having your information stored across, you know, all of the different things that exist in the Shopify universe.
100%. And it goes back to like that you know, expectation shift that I was talking about, how there's Amazon, you know, and some of the other incumbents like really pushing it down from the top. And then there are the buyers that are kind of pushing it from the bottom, because they're like, well, we want that free 2 day shipping. Well, what I was, you know, so impressed with, you know, Shopify rolling this out is, of course, you know, Shopify's typical, like most technology solutions, their customer acquisition is going after the brands from the top. But if you can roll out something like this, where that ease of checkout is so easy, and the buyers start realizing like, oh, I'm on a Shopify site. And if they almost, you know, from now, if we start thinking about from the bottoms up, if they start kind of pushing the third party websites that they purchased from to move to Shopify because they want that experience, like that's when you've won. And so again, it's the pressure from both sides, which I was just so impressed with.
Yeah. And one of the conversations that's been coming up throughout the podcast over the past few months with Paul Munford from LeanLux, and we had Think Testing on recently, is kind of what's happening on a meta level with so many direct-to-consumer brands emerging and popping up all the time. Does that create confusion or complexity for the user? Because now, instead of being able to go on Amazon and buy all the stuff in one place, they're shopping across, you know, dozens of different websites. You know, what does that do to the user experience? Are there efficiencies to be gained there?
I mean, gosh, we could talk about, you know, we could peel this back for hours. I think what a lot of the brands are realizing, and this happened, obviously been happening for a long time, but is they just need to be wherever their customer is. So basically the customer wants to buy what they want, you know, when they want it and get it, you know, pretty quickly. And so it's really that omni-channel push where they don't care if they're buying it on your website or if they're buying on Instagram, and we can dive into what they just rolled out shortly, or if they're buying it in the store. You know, you need to be where the customer wants to be. But what I do find very, very important, and this is, you know, the really one of the few knocks on Amazon who I have, you know, that most respect for, is these brands need to own as much of that customer data as possible. And that's not like in a nefarious way, but like that's how they're going to actually be able to make smart and actionable decisions on how they should build and scale their brands. Where if you're handing that data everywhere else and you don't understand who's buying and you're not able to engage with them or build a relationship with them or communicate with them or share the latest and greatest that your brand has rolled out, you know, you're always trying to fish again from the same sea that everybody else is. And so again, it's I think the technology is rolling out at such an incredible pace where people, both online and offline, where brands can get in front of their customers in so many different ways. But really having that connection with your customers and also having that data where you can actually take action off of is just getting more and more important, you know, by the day.
You mentioned Instagram. I haven't gotten into all the nitty-gritty because it was recently announced as of this recording. But we're seeing them really integrate the shopping experience directly into the app where, you know, if you see a product you like, you're actually able to check out from right there and buy the product and presumably, you know, have all of your payment and shipping and everything information saved so that is as seamless as possible. What's your thought on you know, how that will go over and whether that'll be successful and from an implementation standpoint, what that means for brands?
Oh, I think it was so smart. I mean, it's funny, like all technology companies become, you know, a payments company. And that's what Instagram and obviously Facebook, who controls Instagram, is trying to be. They're trying to get as close to, you know, the wallet as possible. I feel like I'm always fascinated how much money these brands will be spending on Instagram and Facebook, but primarily Instagram to drive customer acquisition. I was talking to an agency partner of ours the other day, and they said that they spent between $400 and $500 million on Instagram last year. That is insane. And the fact now that these brands can actually spin up a store or sell directly through Instagram and have that checkout experience right there. And I was fortunate, you know, while I was at BigCommerce to watch this, because BigCommerce along with Shopify and PayPal were launch partners of Instagrams that they announced the other day. And so, you know, I was fortunate to see a lot of this coming. But what's interesting is, you know, while Instagram announced that they did launch with both Shopify and BigCommerce, they picked 20 brands to launch with, and none of those brands were using native integrations with Shopify or BigCommerce. They were doing it through Instagram. And I think that we'll see a lot of brands, even if they're spinning out test products where they just want to run stuff on Instagram to see how it works, or you'll see these influencers that want to start spinning up brands, and they don't necessarily need to spin up, you know, their Shopify store. They can actually just spin up, you know, an Instagram store and start selling their merchandise directly there. A lot of like the musicians and artists can do that, where they don't want to necessarily maintain a store. But they need to be very careful, of course, is what is the customer data that you're getting so you can continue to interact with them. But, you know, Instagram controls all of that as is. And then a company that hasn't been really getting much publicity, I feel like, over the last year, compared to some of the other players, is PayPal. And PayPal right now is powering the wallet for Instagram. How long they do that for, I don't know. I believe they signed a somewhat long-term contract, but what that means, I don't know. But you know, it's, if they might have a similar agreement to like what Shopify has with Stripe, where Shopify essentially white labels Stripe for Shopify payments. And if Instagram's doing that with PayPal, PayPal is going to be a huge winner in this space.
I wonder what the expectations are if you're someone who's shopping on Instagram for kind of the end product, because I think that currently brands who are really trying to create an amazing, you know, unboxing experience and checkout experience and like browsing navigation experience, they're trying to think about that from a very branded standpoint end to end. But what does that mean if you're just scrolling through your feed and you see your friend's cat, and then the next thing you see is a product and you buy that? Are you thinking this is like Amazon and it doesn't matter if it comes in a brown box and, you know, it's sort of just like a thing that I got from Instagram? Or are you expecting for it to come in an Instagram branded box? Or are you expecting for it to come, you know, from the brand itself and be very branded? I'm not totally sure what people will expect when they do that.
I agree. And it'll be interesting too, where having some layers of friction is actually a good thing, because, you know, these customers are actually not just showing you that they want your product, but they're also kind of, every layer of friction that they overcome, they're also selling themselves on the product. And so, you know, there are theories like, well, will these brands start to see like a huge influx in return orders? Will they see a bunch of people that are not return shoppers, because I don't know what Instagram, I don't know all the nuances of the data that they're sharing, their ability to allow you to retarget or even like message the customers that purchase. So are you going to see a huge reduction in repeat visitors? And also, will you see the average order value drop, which is extremely important? And so I don't know. I mean, there's going to be a lot that we're going to see. And I think this is where also thinking through that post-purchase experience is actually maybe even more important, because if you order a handful of things through Instagram and they are coming in the brown box and they're coming late and the quality is not that strong, I mean, honestly, that sounds to me kind of like what Kickstarter was in the early days, and you're not going to come back. But if you actually but for the brands that do take it seriously and they, you know, they are getting you your products in a timely manner and it is coming in, you know, that custom box, or there's some type of like personalized experience there, I think that those are the types of brands that people will then share further and also then seek out to make sure that they're, you know, visiting them on their website and then probably, and then hopefully, you know, reentering their ecosystem there as well.
I've got a prediction. I wasn't thinking about this before, but with your description, it just came to mind. I think what we'll do really well is just impulse buys. We don't have that notion necessarily on the internet of, you know, when you're, I mean, Amazon sort of does this to some extent, you know, here's some upsell type of things. And a lot of e-commerce websites do upsell, but there isn't necessarily a thing where, you know, you're walking down the aisle of a grocery store, and as you get to the checkout, there's all the chewing gum and silly magazines and all that kind of stuff. Is there a version of that that, you know, populates in your feed? Is the customer acquisition cost of that make sense? But is there a way that you're, you know, scrolling through and you see this thing and it's like $5 or $10 and you buy it instantly? What is that thing? Is it a pair of socks? Is it, you know, chewing gum? if it's something that can be shipped in a very simple envelope or something that is, you know, prepackaged to be shipped, I could see that doing really well because it's an instant purchase. And if they make the checkout flow within Instagram super easy, where it's literally, you know, basically instant buy, I could see that working really well.
I agree. There was this brand I worked with a couple of years ago. They sold those car mounts for your phone. I think they're very popular with moms and like Uber drivers and people who often like maybe needed to have like be able to talk on the phone while driving, of course, because you need to be hands-free. And this guy, his site blew up. I think he scaled it up to 5 million plus within like a couple months. And I remember talking with him, I'm like, well, you know, what was your thought process to scale to this amount? Because this was like his 25th e-commerce store. So he was not a rookie. And he was telling me, he's like, well, all of our marketing is through Facebook and Instagram. I worked with our designer and developer where I was like, I don't want to see a desktop mock-up until the very end. We're going to create everything mobile responsive, and then we can scale it out to desktop. And I want as few pages and clicks as possible. And on the checkout page, there's the ability to get 1, 3, and 5. And so you can kind of get those. And he viewed it as, you know, it's like you're at the, you know, the grocery store and it's that impulse buy. He wanted people to see it. And I think even for 5 of them, it was less than $30. And he wanted that checkout extremely quickly. And he was using all those one-click buy buttons, like the Amazon buy button, the PayPal one-click, Apple Pay. And I think I remember he emailed me, he was like celebrating that he actually got his first purchase that was less than a minute, because he'd keep a close eye on that. And so, of course, the person had to click the ad, navigate through his site, you click one of the one-click payment buttons, and then check out. But now you think about it with Instagram, like what you were saying, like talk about impulse buy. If I see whatever it may be, Bombas socks or something cool like that, I click on it. And then if I can basically, if my payment credential is already saved, I mean, in theory, I could probably purchase in like 10 seconds, which is mind blowing.
Yeah, for anything where there isn't that much of a decision, like either you already know the product, maybe you've bought it before and it's like a replenishment of that thing, or it's something where you're willing to take the risk because it's like, hey, you know, I know the concept of, just think about a grocery store. If you understand the concept of a candy bar, it's not a big risk to, you know, buy one. The question would be, the acquisition costs and the advertising costs on Instagram have gone up so much. Is it possible to sell an impulse buy in that context? And does Instagram want to be, you know, the checkout line of the internet?
I mean, they're basically like the QVC of the internet. But what will be also interesting too is, will they reward those that sell through Instagram? Because what if you actually got a benefit by getting like a reduction in your cost per click? Therefore, or at least in theory, your cost per acquisition by selling through Instagram.
Fascinating. Well, these are all questions that we don't know the answer to yet, but it'll be fascinating to see.
It will be.
And what does that mean for fulfillment, right? Is there anything that you know, it inspires you to think about when it comes to the integrations with the different storefronts, the actual like experience of receiving a product that you would buy that way?
Yeah, well, I'm glad you brought that up, because that's something that I thought about quite a bit, where especially with these buy buttons, again, you know, the PayPal one click, which is still extremely popular, the Amazon checkout button, you know, Apple Pay. As you go through this experience, and let's just take the Amazon buy button, which is very popular. It's also what Kickstarter used from the beginning, but again, you go through, let's, you know, this beautiful branded website, you purchase the product you're going for, you use the Amazon buy button, it takes you, you know, a couple clicks to check out, you never had to hit your keyboard, it's on the way, and so you get this Amazon level purchase experience. But then on the checkout page, it says, great, it will be there in 7 to 10 business days. And so you don't get that Amazon level you know, fulfillment. It's such a disjointed experience. You only got half of that Amazon experience. And I think that's what brands are realizing and trying to focus on, outside of the fact that they're seeing wins elsewhere. And, but is how do you create that entire experience? There's a reason why Amazon, you know, was at least for a time, a $1 trillion company, because they did that entire, you know, it was the entire experience. It wasn't just the purchase experience. It wasn't just the fulfillment experience. It was everything.
Awesome. Well, it's been amazing to talk to you. I think if people are curious about ShipBob itself, you can go to shipbob.com. If they want to hear more of your insights, where can they find you? Twitter?
Yeah, Twitter, at CASEYA, so at KCA, or you can always email me too, carmstrong@shipbob.com.
Is there anything else you want to point people to? You've been publishing a lot on the blog, different case studies, different guides, that kind of stuff.
We put a lot of time and effort into our resources and our case studies. And I think hearing from those that are in the trenches is the best way to learn. And so I would always start there. And I think the fastest way to accelerate your professional growth is to talk to those, preferably in person or you know, over Skype or somewhere else, you know, the people that have done it. And so that's where I always recommend people to start for sure.
Cool. Thank you, Casey.
Thank you very much.
Ooh, one last thing before we go. I'm talking to you at home. What's your favorite brand these days? Is there something that you think is really well made? Or maybe someone that you'd love for me to talk to? Send us a tweet. We are at Lumi, L-U-M-I, on Twitter. We're making this show for you, so tell us what you want to hear, and we'll make it happen. Thanks. See you next time.